It is Monday, November the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the 100th anniversary of World War I.
It is our duty to preserve the civilization they defended and to protect the peace they so nobly gave their lives to secure one century ago.
And fears are escalating over hostilities in Yemen.
Increasing conflict between the two and leading to a much larger loss of human life could very well give some degree of support to the Al-Qaeda.
U.S.-China relations plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump joined dozens of world leaders at a ceremony in Paris on Sunday, remembering the fallen soldiers of World War I. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was there.
This is all tied, of course, to the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, exactly 100 years past that moment when the armistice was declared. It was not a surrender of the Germans, but rather a halt to the fighting after 4 years of just what had been an unprecedented bloody battle across the Western Front of Europe. And it was a moment of great relief. And 100 years later, it is being remembered here at the Arc de Triomphe. We have dozens of world leaders here, including President Trump, under a rainy sky.
That is VOA White House Bureau's Chief Steve Herman in Paris. From those ceremonies at the Arc de Triomphe, President Trump visited the Suresnes American Cemetery and Memorial. It's in the suburbs of Paris. There he paid tribute to soldiers killed in World War I.
Each of these marble crosses and stars of David marks the life of an American warrior. Great, great warriors they are, who gave everything for family, country, God, and freedom.
Mr. Trump called World War I a horrible, horrible war that marked America's emergence as a world power. He then spoke about the duty everyone should bear.
This is all tied, of course, to the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, exactly 100 years past that moment when the armistice was declared. It was an honor.
It is our duty to preserve the civilization they defended and to protect the peace they so nobly gave their lives to secure one century ago.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist. She speaks about all of this with VOA's Lori London.
One of the most important events was just north of Paris on Saturday when the French President Emmanuel Macron stood arm-in-arm with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel on the same site where 100 years ago, to the day that armistice agreement was signed. Here were two old foes united for peace, Germany and France, two nations along with the rest of the world whose people, whose young men had exhausted themselves killing one another. Suddenly, we're there, we're together, and that was a very symbolic moment. There's been several other symbolic moments over the last few decades of German and French leaders coming together, but this one, at this moment in history where there has been fears of a resurgence of nationalist tensions, this was a big moment for the weekend. And seeing Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron together really brought home to a lot of people that they understand the sacrifices that families made in the First World War, and they understand the need for unity so as countries, people can learn from those mistakes. I think the next big image that people will take away from Sunday, which was Armistice Day, was a picture of world leaders walking shoulder to shoulder up the Champs-Élysées in Paris towards the Arc de Triomphe in that symbolic show of unity. This idea that 100 years on, more than 70 heads of state and heads of international organizations get together one place and say, we know where the world went wrong. Let's try and not make that mistake again.
There were, though, some things that stood out that were slightly on the controversial side or certainly raised some eyebrows. One of them, President Macron's speech, certainly seemed to be aimed quite a bit at the U.S. president.
Absolutely. Emmanuel Macron's speech was really one in which he warned against withdrawal, isolationism. He called isolationism a grave error and it will be condemned by future generations. He talked about war being the result of collective failure, of nationalism being a betrayal. And it was really very closely and very, if you like, precisely aimed at Donald Trump and aimed at America. Because Emmanuel Macron, in his speech, he really did make disturbing parallels with the resurgence of nationalist tensions, which happened after the end of the First World War, and what's happening today. He also referred to, obliquely, he referred to that period at the end of the First World War when America disengaged from Europe after that crucial intervention on the side of the Allies in 1917 and through to the end of the First World War. After that, America withdrew. And Macron really did sort of point at that and say, look, we should be looking at the mistakes that were made in those inter-year wars. There is also this question of whether what happened at the end of the First World War is relevant today. And Emmanuel Macron said, yes, very much so, because the demons that were there that caused the First World War and caused the uncertainty after the end of the First World War, he said, are in a resurgence. They're resurfacing. And he said, this is there. It's in our communities, and it's ready to wreak chaos and death. And he said, and I'm quoting here, history sometimes threatens to take its sinister course once again. And that is very clearly a message from Emmanuel Macron that the world's stability is threatened by nationalism and extremism.
That is Catherine Field. She is a Paris-based journalist and was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, while those events marking the 100th anniversary of World War I were being held in both London and Paris, no major events were planned in Germany, which suffered millions of casualties. As we heard from Catherine Field, Chancellor Angela Merkel was on hand in Paris. The German president was in London. Stephen Van Evra is a political science professor at MIT University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty quite a miracle was achieved in Europe since the 20th century's two world wars.
War has become unthinkable in a place where blood used to flow in rivers. War is now really essentially impossible among the major European states, and people take that for granted. But the achievement's quite amazing. People should learn from it. And a major reason why war has become unthinkable is because the European understanding of history has changed in a very good way. Europeans used to each taught their own chauvinistic, mythical version of history that gloried themselves and blamed others for all of the world's troubles and all past conflicts. And since World War II, that's all been changed, and Europeans now basically all agree, not totally, but overall, on who was responsible for past conflicts, including who was responsible for World War I. And this has greatly calmed everybody's sense of grievance against one another and suspicion and entitlement. And it's been a fundamental reason why Europe is now so deeply at peace. And the people who get the biggest credit for this are the Germans. Inside Germany, there's been a truth-telling movement that's really been working since the 60s, and especially the 70s, at inculcating German society with a, shall we say, honest version of the origins of World War I and World War II and the Holocaust. And the Germans really now lead the world as, shall we say, a truth-telling nation, a nation whose culture is dedicated to not fudging the ugly past, but telling the truth even on one's own wrongdoings. And this has just changed European politics much for the better. In my view, the greatest ungiven but deserved Nobel Peace Prize should go to the truth tellers of Germany, the historians and school teachers.
Can World War I happen again?
No. And that's one of the key reasons. It can't for several reasons, but a big one, maybe the biggest, is that the nationalistic history that fired up Europe for World War I has now been, you know, put in the grave by this commonization of history understanding in Europe. There's several other reasons, too. The American police presence in Europe, the integration of the economies, the democratization of Europe, those are several other things. But I think this history story is the biggest one, and it gets the least attention.
What did we learn from the First World War?
Another warning to draw from the war is the danger of what people then called militarism, by which they meant the undue influence of professional militaries over civilian perceptions about foreign policy and security. One of the root causes of the war was the undue influence of the German military over German civilians, over the way they thought and the way they perceived things. And their influence was very pernicious. They basically inculcated Germany with a sort of social Darwinist view of world politics in which countries had to grow or die. And if you didn't attack your neighbors now, they might attack you later, so you better attack them now. And they also inculcated society with a really, truly bizarre image of the nature of warfare, painting warfare as a positive exercise, over in a hurry, short, wars will be short, wars will be quite cheap and fairly bloodless and almost uplifting and enjoyable. which starts, you know, hard to believe, but this was the common image of war before 1914. The warning here is you don't want to have, shall we say, any national security institution sort of dominating how everybody thinks. The country that sort of it looks like Germany today is Pakistan, and I think Pakistan really is, in my view, the most dangerous country in the world. And one reason why it's so dangerous is because it's really it's a rebirth of Wilhelmine Germany in the way that the military dominate Pakistan, and they've led Pakistan into very dangerous ideas about foreign policy.
MIT Stephen Van Everill likened World War I to a boulder tumbling downhill, creating an even larger landslide. He said the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles left Germans bitter and paved the way for the Second World War. He said had there been no First War, there would have been no Second, no Hitler, no Holocaust, perhaps even avoiding the rise of communism, the Cold War, and related conflicts like Korea and Vietnam. Dr. Van Everill was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Street battles raged on Sunday in several areas of Yemen's contested port city of Hodeidah, where a U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition is trying to drive out Iranian-backed Shiite rebels. The conflict in Yemen began with the 2014 takeover of the capital, Sana'a, by the rebels known as Houthis, who toppled the internationally recognized government there. A Saudi-led coalition allied with the government has been fighting the Houthis since 2015 in an attempt to restore the mostly exiled government to power. Middle East Institute adjunct scholar Zubair Iqbal spoke with VOA about the crisis in Yemen. We asked him if U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's call for an end to hostilities so peace negotiations can take place is about the Americans playing a key role in ending the conflict.
Strategically speaking, at this moment, the American interest is actually subject to some degree of uncertainty as well as fear of aggressive reaction. Now, what we see today is that the Saudi coalition is afraid that they are not going to get as much support as they were expecting or as they have had in the past. And because that support will be lacking, and as you already know, that the mid-air refueling has been basically terminated. So under these circumstances, they want to speed up the process and be as aggressive as possible. And on the other side, Houthis also realize it, and they're doing the same thing. But in the process, something very seriously wrong has happened. One is that the Houthis are actually very seriously considering, as I understand, the missile attacks on the UAE as well as on Saudi Arabia. And under the new revised conditions or changed conditions, strategic conditions in the region, these kinds of attacks may not be condemned as much as they were condemned in the past. That's dangerous. The second issue that I'm afraid of is that the increasing conflict between the two and leading to a much larger loss of human life could very well give some degree of support to the Al-Qaeda. So we have a very awkward situation on our hands. The participants are trying to strengthen their position in order to seek negotiations, if possible, under the UN system. The Americans want to move in order to make sure that that happens and is successful. Third position is that the strategic position in that region has weakened. And American involvement and interest has to be stronger if it wants to preserve its own national interest.
Zubair Iqbal, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. China has told the U.S. to stop sending American ships and military aircraft close to those islands Beijing claims in the South China Sea. The top Chinese diplomat made his government position clear after the latest round of U.S.-China security talks here in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the United States is not seeking to heighten tensions with China.
Even as our countries confront important differences in the bilateral relationship between the nations, our cooperation remains essential on many, many central issues.
The Trump administration has criticized China's militarization of the South China Sea. We asked Atlantic Council senior fellow Robert Manning, was anything resolved at the Washington meeting between U.S. and Chinese officials?
I don't know if I'd use the word resolve, but I think this was an attempt to kind of put a floor under a very volatile U.S.-China relationship. And I think it probably succeeded in doing that. I think there were some points where we moved things forward, particularly on how to manage risk in air and sea situations where the U.S. and Chinese forces are in close proximity, in South China Sea being one of them, where we've had a number of incidents, one not too long ago. And we've had agreements with them that haven't worked out well, haven't been activated well enough to so the operators on the ground can talk to each other and avoid incidental conflicts and accidental things happening. And I think they've improved that a certain amount. I think on South China Sea, we have serious disagreements with the Chinese. It's an odd situation since we're defending a treaty we refuse to ratify, and they ratified a treaty they interpret the way they will, kind of an a la carte sort of way. But they continue to build, all the reports that I see, they're continuing to build military facilities on the disputed islands in the South China Sea. And it's a difficult situation for the U.S. because I think what happened a long time ago when it started was the Chinese, in effect, made a bet that the U.S. would not risk going to war over a bunch of rocks and reefs in which they had no claim to defend a treaty they wouldn't ratify, to defend sea lanes that are not threatened in peacetime. And so I think so far the Chinese have been proven right. We've run an increasingly bold effort at freedom of navigation operations, but the Chinese have in effect changed the status quo, and we have not been able to undo that.
That is Atlantic Council senior fellow Robert Manning. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that its Parker solar probe recently brushed past the sun, getting to within 24 million kilometers of its surface. The space agency says that it is the first spacecraft to get so close to the sun. Mission controllers at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab say they received a status beacon from the spacecraft that indicates it's operating well after its solar flyby. They also report that as it reached its closest point to the sun so far, the spacecraft reached a speed of a little over 343,000 kilometers per hour. Before its mission ends in about 6 years, the Parker Space Probe is expected to get to within 6 million kilometers from the sun's surface. The spacecraft was launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida at 0731 UTC on August 12. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
What a day this has been. Oh, what a rare mood I'm in. Why, it's almost like being in love, and there's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love.
Nicole Henry is an American jazz singer. She won the 2013 Soul Train Music Award for Best Traditional Jazz Performance, nominated alongside Tony Bennett, George Benson, Terrence Blanchard, and Jeffrey Osborne. She got honors for songs like Almost Like Being in Love.
I could swear I was falling. Oh, it's almost like being in love. Oh, what a day this
has been, in what a rare mood I am in, why it's almost like being in love, and there's a smile on my face for the whole human race, why it's almost like being in love, all the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for.
Nicole Henry was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her father, Al Henry, moved his family when he played basketball for the Philadelphia 76ers, and she grew up in a small community not far from Philadelphia, where she pursued the arts from a young age, singing in school and church and studying cello and ballet. Henry graduated from the University of Miami with a double major in advertising and theater. And in an interview with DC Live Music at the Blues Alley Club here in Washington, Henry said her aunt, singer Debbie Henry, helped her find her voice.
And I would see in concert, actually, Patti LaBelle, because my aunt sang backup for Patti LaBelle. So I had an opportunity to really see stage presence and see a show and see entertainment. So I think that, and my aunt being a singer, who's still my favorite voice, one of my favorite voices of today, you know, seeing her and hearing her perform, those were my influences.
That's All is always on Nicole Henry's playlist, and fans love to hear her sing the classic.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and a promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own is for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter's night. That's all, that's all.
Nicole Henry launched her entertainment career with success in both singing and acting. Early on, she appeared in commercial acting roles and voiceover assignments. In 2000, she toured as a background singer for Robert Bradley's Blackwater Surprise, performing dance music. And she discovered jazz while singing in Miami Beach when her then-bassist invited her to learn some jazz standards, such as The Very Thought of You.
The very thought of you I forget to do. The little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. This may seem to me it's everything.
In 2002, Nicole Henry was named Best Solo Musician, and later awards included Best New Jazz Artist and many more. The Huffington Post's Sean Martinfield once wrote, "That predicted time of greatness has arrived. Nicole Henry emerges hands down as this generation's First Lady of Jazz. She's the genuine article, the dream at last come true."
Each moment goes until I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower, your eyes and stars above. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you.
We've seen her perform a number of times, and I have to always say, when I leave the club and I've heard her sing, I always feel better about the world because of the way Nicole Henry sings about it. Beautiful, beautiful voice. You should check her out on YouTube and on social media. Well worth the effort. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington hoping you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Nicole Henry.
This is Today in History. On November 12, 1815, American women's rights pioneer Elizabeth Cady Stanton was born. She agitated not just for the right for women to vote, but also for the right to a higher education, a professional career, and a legal identity. On this day in 1866, Sun Yat-sen, often referred to as the father of modern China, was born. Sun became the first provisional president of the Republic of China in 1912, ending centuries of dynastic rule. In 1927, Leon Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Communist Party, leaving Joseph Stalin in control of the Soviet Union. Trotsky was later deported and exiled to Mexico. In 1929, Academy Award-winning American actress Grace Kelly was born. She would marry Prince Rainier III of Monaco, becoming widely known as Princess Grace in 1956. In 1948, the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, known as the Tokyo War Trials, adjourned after convicting 25 of 28 Japanese civilian and military officials of war crimes committed during the Second World War. In 1954, Ellis Island, the main U.S. immigration control center located in New York Harbor, closed its doors after processing the last of the millions of immigrants that had moved through its doors since 1892. In 1980, Voyager 1, an unmanned American spacecraft, was the first to send back detailed close-up pictures of Saturn, its moons, and rings. In 1991, Indonesian forces opened fire on a crowd of student protesters in Dili, East Timor. More than 250 demonstrators were shot and killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.